listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We've got a special guest today, pharmacist turned comedian, Mahesh Katagi. Did I say the last name right?
Mahesh, you got it right. Yeah, you got
it. All right. I was just worried. I was like, man, maybe the G is G instead of Gi. So, but you're Indian. It's got to be Gi. All right.
Come on, man. You got to get it right.
How are you, dude?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me on the show. How have you been?
I'm good, and I thank you for being flexible to do the show earlier. We're pre-taping today because the sun is out. Usually it's 8 o'clock, but you know what? I love that we do shows during the day. So thank you for being flexible. You are first pharmacist turned comedian. Let's talk about that for a second. You were like, I don't want to give people their drugs. I want to give jokes instead of drugs. That's it. Tell me what made you shift, because that's a major shift.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's the Indian, grown up Indian kind of thing. It's a side effect of that, you know? So for me, I grew up in, we've lived all over, but I grew up mostly in Texas. And then
what city in Texas?
We grew up outside of Dallas.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. And then growing up, I watched TV a lot. I loved comedy. I loved stand up. I didn't know that I could possibly do it,
right?
Looking like me. And, but it was just something like, I was like, I feel like I want to do this. And, whole typical Indian Desi thing, parents like go to med school. So I was pre-med and was horrible at it.
Right.
And I was like, oh no, this is not for me. And, so my roommate at the time was in pharmacy. He was applying to pharmacy school. He was like, yeah, just try this. I was like, all right, cool. I don't know what happened. I ended up doing okay on the test. Had been studying for the MCAT.
Indian, that's what happened, dude. Of course.
Yeah, I was trying to be humble. But, I woke up and I passed the test.
That's all. You're like, I didn't study, but I'm Indian, so I passed the test.
You know, the true story, I forgot that. So I've been studying for the MCAT for like a year and a half, and I was like, I'm sure some listeners are familiar. You get like out of like 40 points or something, you need like a 35 or 30 is good. I was taking practice tests and I was getting like consistently, I was getting like a 10.
Wow.
10 to 12. I was like, I wasn't even qualified to take the exams. I signed up for this pharmacy exam, which is hard too. But I think because I had been studying for this, it worked out. And so I was like, cool, I'll do pharmacy. And that was like, my parents were like, hey, you can do whatever you want. You can follow your dreams, but go get a degree first.
Were they like, oh, you're going to do pharmacy, you're not doing medicine?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You're not full Indian then.
Like, it has doctor of pharmacy. It's not a real doctor.
Right. That's right. Hey, it still counts. You know what I mean? It's like you can get an honorable doctorate at this point. You're still a doctor at that point.
It still counts. As long as one person calls you a doctor, you're in the system.
It's funny. A lot of people don't realize how much of that pressure is there. My family actually didn't pressure me into it, but I was like, oh, this is what I should do. So I was pre-med in music my freshman year. And then I moved into my college dorm. And I had all music majors. And so like, I was like, oh, this must be like because of the music school. And then I went to the music school and I was asking all my peers. I'm like, oh, so you guys all live with musicians, like all music majors? And everybody was like, no, my roommate's a biology major. My roommate studies geology. Another person was like, oh, he studies psychiatry. I'm like, oh, this is the wind talking then. Like, what are the chances? We're the only room that it's all music majors.
So I
quickly got out of that. But it was hard to kind of like, breach that subject, like, I don't know if I want to do this. Tell me what that was like for you, because, that's a huge conversation. I know from the family. So tell me what that was like for you.
Well, that's funny about the music thing, because when I was in college, I mean, I knew I liked comedy, but at the time I had been playing guitar for a few years, and I had these dreams of like, oh, I want to be in a band, I want to do all that. And I had that conversation with my parents. I was like, you know, I'm doing biology. I think I want to do like music and like this. And they're like, it doesn't make any money. Like, what are you going to do after that? I was like, we're not going to support you. And I was like, fine. But also, it also helped that I couldn't keep on beat with anything. Like, I played guitar, but I was terrible.
That's awesome. I love that you're like, you know, I want to be a musician. They're like, come on, that's not going to make any money. You're like, fine, I'll do stand-up comedy.
Which just makes even less money.
But you know what? There's a chance, like, there's always a chance with entertainment in general. It's like, if you just, you know, I think the one thing you've learned, you know, as any artist does, is we make faster money. Like, yes. like we know that we can make a lot of money very fast. Mm-hmm. And that's what we love, because we don't want to spend, like, you know, other jobs are secure and they're consistent, but God, they pay so much less. Whereas we're like, let me do what I love, make money fast, and then I can do what I want with my life for the other amount of time. And that's what people don't realize, is like, that time is precious, because who wants to spend 80 hours or 70 hours or 60 hours doing something you don't want to do a week? You know what I mean?
For sure. And I get it. Like, the immigrant mentality of coming in is just, it's more of a survival thing, but I'm like, I feel like they did that. They did that, like, hardship and stuff for us to be able to be like, you know what? I appreciate it, but I really want to try this. And I think the one thing is, we have the work ethic built in, like, from day zero, you know, like, so whatever we're going to do, we're going to do it. Like, we're going to figure out a way to do it, I think.
And who was, like, a major comedian for you? You said you were watching comedy. Was it like Eddie Murphy? Like, who were the comedians that were influenced? Yeah.
Honestly, like, for me, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, Dave Chappelle, like, Killing Them Softly, like, those albums, I would watch it, I would listen to it, because we didn't have cable, so I'd see it at my friend's house. I'd be like, what is this? Oh, it's like a dude just talking, and it's hilarious. And then, for me, what really pushed me in, and I think that this is for most brown comics, when Russell Peters' special came out on YouTube, we were on, like, LimeWire, all that stuff in college, and people were just sending it to each other, downloading it. And I was like, I remember, because I was watching it with my roommate, and we were like, whoa, this is crazy. And it was like the other comics that you can relate, because it's funny, it's observational, it's growing up, but this hit us in a different way of, it's like, oh, he's talking about Indian parents. It's like, yes, okay, my uncle does the same thing. My dad does the same thing. And it's like, it kind of gave me that thing of, maybe I could do it. And then that kind of set the chain reaction of, you know.
He definitely was an outlier. Like, he just was like, no, I'm not going to do anything that my parents think I should do.
Yeah.
And I'm really successful at doing it. And he kind of, like, he's created a model that, you know, not many people can emulate in the same way. Maybe it was the timing thing, but
man,
I love all those comedians that you said. I actually played Bonnaroo, and Chris Rock was one of the headliners.
Oh, wow.
So I saw Chris Rock in front of, like, literally 100,000 people. He was one of the headliners. Wow. It was so awesome. I was like, this is why I love music. And music and comedy, they're so in parallel, because we both love timing so much, and it's all about rhythm and, like, how you kind of, like, build to a climax in the moment. And you know, that's one of the things that I love about comedians. I just have so many comedian friends, like you and Rajiv and other people. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's I marvel at comedians, because they are some of the sharpest people, you know, intellectually, and what they're saying progressively, what their, like, views are on the world. They are definitely, like, they go for broke. Like, they swing for the fences every time. And that's one of the things I love about comedians, because it's like, they're not afraid to say what people should be kind of, like, thinking about or looking at. Tell me, like, how that affects you and when you're crafting art, even on an observational level or a political level.
No, for sure. It's, you know, it's hard, because it's like, they say it takes about, like, 5 years to really get your rhythm in comedy, and, like, about 10 years to, like, find your voice, which I never really understood. And I'm, like, about, like, what, like, 11, 12 years in now. And I feel like I'm finally just, like, figuring out, like, okay, this is what I want to talk about. This is kind of the messages I want to have in my comedy. I mean, I think underlying thing is you just got to make people laugh. I think it sounds so basic, but then it's like after that, it's like layering, like, what kind of comic do you want to be? Do you want to be observational? Do you want to be a political person? Do you want to be like raunchy? Like, and for me, it's taken, I've gone through different phases where I've been like, let me try this. When I was working, you know, early on, I was like, I don't want to be offensive. I don't want to say anything. I don't want to, you know, even talk about politics. And then I was like, you know what? I'll try it. And I did political jokes. And I remember doing shows in, like, you know, deep in Pennsylvania, and people were like, don't do those jokes anymore. And here I was like, all right, cool, I won't do it. You know, but I think part of it is just learning like what you like. And for me, I've always been into like the observational kind of comedy. And that's what I love. And I'm right now I'm seeing it through the different lens of like, you know, the phases of, you know, dating, marriage, kids, and then just like working and just the world. And I'm like, everything's observational. So it's like, it's taken me a while. It's one of those things that I don't know if you feel like this yourself with the music is like, I'll watch stuff from like years ago. At the time I was like, okay, this is good. I'm on the right track. Now I'll watch like, I sent you a few clips and I was like, oh man, this is terrible.
No, that's, you know, I'll tell you this. This is, I've interviewed so many comedians. That's every comedian. And I'll tell you the difference between musicians and comedians. When musicians are in that moment, we think the opposite. We're like, oh, this is awful. This is so terrible. Then as years go by, we're like, oh, this isn't that bad. And comedians are the exact opposite. This is what I noticed. They're like, that was pretty good. And then they watch it years later, like, oh, I can't watch this. This is awful. So there's like this like self-criticism that you guys have as comedians and artists. Where, and I think a lot of it is you take so much time to whittle and craft the joke that once the joke is over and you know it so well, the thought of you like reliving it, even if it's a good joke, you're like, nah, this is awful. You know what I mean? You're past it. So I don't even think it's the actual, I don't think the metrics of measuring the performance are as accurate, because every comedian talks like this. Like even getting them to send me YouTube clips on this show, it's like, oh man, I really don't like doing that. I'm like, dude, you've got to, because you know, we can talk about comedy, that's one thing, but people want to see your comedy too. You're a comedian, they want to see clips. This is how we relive a moment or an act, for sure. So tell me where that comes from. Are you just hard on yourself about jokes, or are you over jokes even if they work because you're onto something else?
I think it's a mix of stuff. And this is speaking for myself and some of my close friends. It's just, I think coming from like the New York scene is kind of where I came up and, you know, I spent most of my time. It's brutal in the sense of somebody will tell you to your face, you suck and you should quit. And if you come back the next day, they'll be like, you still suck, but I respect you for sticking with it because you still want to do it. You know?
That's intense.
And the crowds too. It's like, they're not there to mess around. They want to hear comedy. And I think something about that, you start seeing these other people working out. Like, when I was starting out, you know, the people that were doing The Cellar, that were doing Gotham, they're huge now. And like, you're seeing them work and you're seeing them like every day they have a new set. I'm like, you're writing that much every single day and you're getting on stage 5 times a day. It just forces you to get better, I think, in a comparison sense of like, you see the crowd. And I think that's one thing with comedy. I think it's important nowadays because everyone's on TikTok, everyone's on Instagram, YouTube. You can't match the feeling of being in the room. Same with music, right? You can listen to an album, it sounds fantastic, but being at that concert, you know, hearing it live, the air, the wind, the smell.
I love live energy no matter what it is. Even if it's like, I know this sounds funny, but even going to a museum, like, you know, I remember seeing Picasso's Guernica in a Spanish book. And I was like, oh, this is such a cool painting. And I went to Madrid and walked into the gallery where it was hanging on the wall. And I was so blown away. It's so big. It takes the size of an entire wall, but in the book, really? It's this big. And you don't realize that. So like when you see it in person, that's when it kind of struck me. I was like 20 years old or 21 years old. I'm like, man, you can't experience art unless you're in the room in the same way.
Yeah.
So I'm always, if I'm not doing a show, I'm at a show because I feel like it gives you inspiration. It's going to like show somebody that's a master of their craft on some level. And then you can take that and kind of like apply it to what you're doing. So it raises your game. I think it's so important. And I love that you say that. So like, who were the comedians that you first saw live in person that became influential?
I mean, right now, like the guys that when I was starting out, they're doing all the clubs, like you got your like Sam Morrills, like your Mark Normans, like all those guys, they're just all over the place. But then it was back and then it was like Colin Quinn, you know, the Dave Attells, like they're out there in doing the club scene. And there's just something about when you're in the club and it's New York is cool because there's a lot of clubs like the Comedy Cellar. I mean, I think that's the dream club in New York.
Yeah, you're playing
in the basement.
Those are like really reputable venues, by the way. Sam, our engineer, just told me that I've got a little bit static on my side. So okay. I'm just going to click on, hold on just a second. I'm going to click on the link and just connect again. Hold on. Just
gotcha. Okay, cool.
Hold that thought, bro. Hold that
yeah,
thought.
Yeah, no worries, man.
All right, hold on.
All right, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, that's much better.
All right, sorry, man. Sometimes my computer just does that. So, all right, so tell me what you were saying. Sorry, it looked like I wasn't paying attention to what you were saying because I was like, okay, I got to find this link real quick. So tell me what you were saying. You were saying the Comedy Cellar and go on with that.
Yeah, so I think there's something about New York. It's like it's kind of dingy. It's kind of dirty. You go into these basements, and I think it's just built for it. Like the ceilings are very low, like acoustically. Right. When you're in there and somebody is just destroying on stage, you feel it. It's like you go stand next to the bass amp and you feel like the vibrations.
Right.
It's like that, man. And it's there's something like so cool about it. And I know it's like, you know, now it's so expensive to go to a show. But if you're able to go to a live comedy show, just go check it out.
Oh, man. It's one of the things I do all the time. I actually just saw Rajiv play at the Ice House.
Oh, yeah.
Sebastian Maniscalco and Howie Mandel and, you know, Marc Maron. And I got to tell you, Sebastian Maniscalco went up there and just slayed it. And Marc Maron, who's a very reputable comedian and has a huge podcast, he went up there and it sucked the air out of the room. It was like, the thing I love about live comedy is like, you can really tell when somebody has the goods and when they don't have the goods, or, you know, like they just have like a super off night. And it's like very hard to be that consistent all the time, but you see the ones that are out there doing it all the time. So do you have, like Steve Martin said in his book, Standing Up, like he would notice the timing being a little bit off if he took like one or two nights off. Do you find that the rhythm of what you do is a little bit off if you take time off?
Absolutely. It's like everyone says it's like going to the gym, which I hate going to the gym, but it's like one of those things. It's like you really feel it. Like I feel like if you take extended, even like a week off, you know, getting back on stage, you feel like the rust on you. And you just like, I'm not saying what I want to say the right way, or because a lot of it is just the feel of the room. And I've noticed, like, you know, when I'm doing like 10 shows in a week in New York, man, that 10th show, it's night and day difference from that first show, just because the confidence and you're just in it. And that's the one thing I like is you can come in with an idea and by the end of the week, you can have like a fleshed out joke. And the live performance, I mean, that's cool that you said with Sebastian. I'm like, Sebastian does arenas.
I know, it's so crazy. That's why I wanted to see. And he's like one of the comedians I've really been wanting to see. So go on.
So good. No, and you saw him in the Ice House, which is a small room, but he's bringing that arena performance into us. So I feel like for him, he's going to do a show no matter where he is, you know?
Right.
And that's the cool thing about that and being able to see. I'm sure he probably tried some new stuff too. And it's like,
yeah,
a lot of times it doesn't work. But then it's like, if the comic's behind it, you're going to be like, all right, you're behind it. And I think that's,
I'll tell you, like all of his jokes worked. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to see him, because it was like not an arena show. It was going to be in a small environment. And, you know, actually he like walked off the stage and I walked up to him. Or actually he was walking right towards me because I was sitting right next to the door. And I was like, yo man, you're the shit, man. I just wanted to tell you. And he was like, thanks, man. And he gave me a little pat on the shoulder. I was just like, yo, I wanted to see this guy in an arena. And now I saw him in this small little place. But that's the thing that is so amazing about comedians. Those small venues are your labs. You know what I mean? Like, people don't realize you're stepping into the lab of a comedian in those small spaces, and you're working stuff out. And that's what is an amazing part of the process. Like, there's so many comedians that are like, and I'm sure you feel the same way. Like, like we said earlier, you whittle a joke till it's ready. And then when it's ready, this is the thing that I think is crazy about comedians. Once it's ready, they're like, eh. They're like, I'm over that. You know, it works and it gets the laughs, and I know it works, but I want something else to whittle. So you're almost addicted to the process, right?
I think that's what it is. And I think the best comedians are, I think you said it right. That's, they're addicted to the process, because there's something so exciting of like, oh, I have an idea. And then it's just like, it's like a, like kind of like putting a puzzle together. You're like, I know this is funny. I just don't know how to make it funny.
Right.
Sometimes it takes years. I mean, I was doing a joke. I did a show Saturday night at this like small theater, and I was like, there's a joke I've been trying to do for like a year, and I finally got it to work. And I don't even remember what I recorded it. I have to like go and watch myself. I don't even know what I changed. I think it was partly the performance of it, partly the energy. And like, I think I cut a few words, but that's the crazy thing. I think,
right.
So there's a comic, Gary Gulman. He's a New York comic. He's phenomenal. He's probably one of the best joke writers out right now. He did a thing on Twitter a few years ago. He has a special that's out on HBO right now. He's got a couple, but he did a thing on Twitter for new comics. He's like, so he gives back so much. Thread on, if you're a new comic, you need to read this. And he did a thread. It was like every day for a year almost, I believe, of tips. Joke writing, performance, and like some of his tips, because his writing is so phenomenal. When you see his stuff, he's like, it's like simple stuff that you learn throughout the process. Some of it, like, oh, put the funny word at the end of the sentence. And there's even something complex of like, these consonants sound funny. Words with pa or ka, like that sounds funny. So if you're writing something, you're using a car, for example, if you're saying like Honda, it's like, okay, it doesn't sound as good as saying like Kia. Like, it just, the word, and it's like so minute details of what makes something funny. And like, you miss one word and nobody's laughing, but you add that one little piece of it. It's like cooking, I guess. I'm not a good cook either, but
You know what? I love all those analogies, because for music, for me, I kind of feel like you strike lightning when the idea comes. And for me, it's like demoing the idea. I get so excited. And then there's a process of, okay, I want to put this in a studio and actually arrange this and record it. And it is such a fun process to actually record the song. And once the song is finished, it's like, oh yeah, okay. So I get that kind of like parallel. And in that process, to reference what you were saying, it's like you change certain things that make it more exciting or more accessible or more, you know, whatever, for, you know, the material to work. So I love that this cat is doing that. What are other influences that you draw from, whether it's like what's happening in the news to like what's happening in your own life autobiographically? Like, what are the things that you draw from?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, everything I can. I mean, news. I've been trying to watch a little bit less news just because it's just
It's intense. Yes, it's intense these days.
That's part of life, right? So I think watching that. I mean, just day to day experiences. I find like even stuff where it's such a boring thing you're doing can be the greatest joke of your career. Like, you could be. I think it just partly you have to just be like open to things. Like, you might just be stuck in traffic and you might see something, oh, that's hilarious. And then now, I mean, again, it's a joke about being stuck in traffic, which, you know, has been done millions of times, but it's
right.
You might notice something that's, oh, nobody's seen that. And I think for me, and I think that's why I like, you know, the greats so much, like all, you know, a lot of the comics we've named, and like, they've been able to take a topic that's so overdone of like, oh, airplane food or like traveling or something, but come at it from a new angle that nobody's talked about. That's like, oh man, like how did I not think of that? You know,
right? When it's right under your nose the whole time, that those are the best. I think it's like when somebody else discovers it, you're like, that is so brilliant. And yet it was right under my nose the whole time and I didn't see it. you know.
And those are the jokes that excite me the most when I think of something and I'm like, oh, I haven't heard this perspective. And then I'll tell, it's funny because you'll, for comics, we do a lot of workshopping with, you know, I have like five or six really close friends that I'll either text during the day, we'll text each other jokes, we'll call each other and be like, what do you think of this idea? And I think for me, the number one thing is when either I hear a joke and I'm like, shit, I wish I had thought of that, or they say that, I'm like, okay, that's a good joke. Cause
that's awesome.
The more you simple know, it is, the better.
What I noticed too with a lot of comedians, it's like if somebody is funny in the room, they'll be like, oh yeah, that's a good one. Like they don't laugh. Comedians don't laugh at other people's shit. Whether you're a comedian or not, they don't want another person to get a laugh and they don't acknowledge that laugh sometimes. Do you notice that with comedians?
Yeah,
or?
For sure. I think sometimes it's that, but I think sometimes too, it's a lot of like, as they're, it's like watching a magician perform, you're like trying to figure out, like, where are they gonna go? And sometimes I'll be watching, it's like sometimes it's hard to enjoy comedy as a comic. I'll be watching and be like, okay, he's this topic and this, these are the three directions I would take it as they're saying the joke, and I'm like, ah, that's what they were going at. Or I'll be like, ah, like Anthony Jeselnik, I like a lot because he has a lot of dark jokes, but it's a lot of just like bait and switch. Like he'll switch out the punchline you'll be expecting, because I think his crowds know he'll be talking about one thing and then he'll switch it at the end. So people are now conditioned to guess the punchline.
Right.
He's gotten even better at hiding the punchline, that you're like, you're thinking it's this, and then it's something totally out of left field. And I'm like, oh man, like how does he even come up with it? So it's like watching a good magician.
I also love when comedians, like, you know the joke and then they improvise it in the moment and change it. So you're like, oh man, that I knew this joke and you made it even funnier by making the pivot or using a different, you know, whether it's a different pronoun, a different noun, a different adjective, or a different, you know, whatever to enhance the joke so that you capture the moment, you know, like in the present, you know. Let's play one of your bits. Well, you were about to say something. What were you about to say?
No. Let's not do that. The other thing, the most uncomfortable thing as a comedian is somebody to watch your stand up and be around.
I can relate to that because I have friends, like, we'll be at a party, they'll be like, oh, let's play your music, and I'm like, no. It's like we get sheepish when we get shy in those moments. But this is a radio show. We are going to focus on your material. What do you want to play first? I'll give you the first. You get the first bullet.
You know what? Dealer's choice. You go ahead. And how about you play it, and then I'll justify the joke after.
Okay. All right. Sam, we're gonna let you choose. Choose any bit. Let's go with whatever you want first.
Help me out, Sam.
I don't have a summer body, everybody. I've got like an autumn body. Like when it's kind of cold like this, this is my time to shine. Layers. Oh yeah, let's do it. I'll go to the beach and stuff. I'll get into the water, but I'm gonna make sure the only part of my body you see is from like my neck up. Because I feel like the ends are pretty good. It's just the middle is very questionable, you know? Like, I feel like I'm the United States of America. The ends are great. The middle, oh my God, what is happening? It's like red, doughy, can't tolerate ethnic foods.
That's good. You had a great parallel, too. So tell me how you cultivated that.
First of all, yeah, that joke. No, I don't do that joke.
Oh, it's good. No, it's good. It's good.
No, thanks. You know, I had it was just one of those things. I was just out and I was at the park, and it was Central Park. I was cold. And then I was like, I think I took a picture and I was like, oh, I look good in that picture. And then I noticed there's like, I had a sweater, I had a jacket, and then I was like, layering works. It's like it's like an easy diet. It's a better alternative than dieting and going to the gym. I'm like, I could just put on more layers and I look better. And that's kind of, that was the seed of it. And it was like fall. And I made a comment to a friend. I was like, oh, I think I got an autumn body. And then I got like a little chuckle. And then I was like, so I started doing that. So the ending part with the comparing it to like the United States, that came later. So I did
cool.
A few times. And for me, that's the kind of stuff that I'm like, can I put in something sneakily, like a little message or something? About like, I'm not like directly politics. I'm not going to talk about like Trump or Biden directly, but like, it's kind of fun sometimes to just throw something in. Like, it's like just a joke. And in this way, I feel like everybody can laugh at it.
Right.
And, I had that comparison. Cause I was like, oh yeah, I got good hair. I got good shoes on, but the middle is just a mess. And then like I started thinking about that. I was like, oh, it's kind of like America. And then I just went from that into, I was like, okay, let me come up with a couple of examples. And then the ethnic foods thing, I said at dinner one day, completely unrelated. And then it just like connected. I was like, oh, I could add that. Cause I'm like, I'm also a bad Indian. I don't eat spicy foods. I grew up in Texas.
What? Yeah, what?
I can't do it, man. Heartburn, indigestion, upset stomach.
The wow. Whole
commercial, you know, but, and that's when I was like, oh, I'm a bad Indian myself. And I grew up in Texas. So I was like, I can't tolerate ethnic foods. And then that's when I was like, oh, those two kind of line up. But it was like maybe like 2 months later that I said that. And I was like, oh, that could work. And then it kind of closed out the joke that I'm like, okay, it needed a little bit of an ending. Yeah. So that
and at that point you're like, okay, I'm releasing the joke. Now I move on to something else.
Yeah. And I'll throw it in here and there, but you know, part of it now I think is tough. And a lot of comics, a lot of like the OG comics have said this too, of you have to put stuff on TikTok, Instagram, and there's this pressure to put content out because that's how fans are finding people. But it really hurts the process of writing.
Right.
If this was 10 years ago, I could have did that joke for a full year and a half and got it so perfect to my new word and maybe even come up with a better ending than what I have now and better example. But like nowadays, if you're not relevantly putting stuff up, people forget about you. So in a way, you have to accelerate the joke writing process. So
right.
Put something up that might not be ready. You know how it is with music. Maybe it's not just right there yet, but you have that pressure to put it out.
Yeah.
And it's not. It must have been nice. Like back, it was nice. I mean, for me starting out, because it's been over 10 years. Like when I started, there was no Instagram, there was no TikTok. You could fail in anonymity. Like
right.
You could go up for years and just bomb every single night and nobody cared. Nobody remembers. Like it's a different
crowd. Well, you know what? The way I look at it, it's also like this. It's like there are good things about that and there are bad things about that. Like the fact that, you know, you're a comedian now and you can be seen doing a bit is actually a huge thing, because you think of back in the day, you had to have a comedy special. You had to have a network. Yes. You had to be a certain color. You had to be a certain, you know, a sex, you know what I mean? Like women weren't getting the voices that they have now. It's like, so like, you know, a lot of things are open now because it's there is a need to be visual, to have stuff out, and you have the control. Like nobody's put, like sometimes people will tape your shows and put them up, but really that's when like things are really start popping, you know. It's like, but yeah. In the beginning, you have control over whatever you put up. And what I noticed myself as an artist, like I'm 20 years in the game now. Now I'm like, put anything up. I don't care if I'm in pajamas playing a guitar solo or I've just got a new guitar pedal and I'm just going to put everything up, because that is, I've done my kind of like my proving myself as far as like, you know, putting it out there. And, you know, there's certain things like I played the Apollo Theater and, you know, I got to tell you, one of my friends that I made was a comedian and the guy was like kind of briefing us before. And he's like, okay, so what are you doing? He's like, oh, I'm doing comedy. And he's like, oh man, they hate comedians. And he was like, well, I'll be the first then that they love. And I was like, oh man, that's really daunting to hear that, you know, like, cause like what he was trying to say was they hate comedians if you're not funny. And the funny thing that's is, funny. Yeah. He started really strong. And like, he was winning them over. He had one bad joke and he got booed so hard, and like they had this giant wall so we can't see anything that anybody's doing, so you can't get an edge I see what worked. There's this giant door and you're just standing by it, which is really awesome that they do that. But I could hear every detail. You know what I mean? Like you heard the intro, you heard when it was going well, and then you heard the lull, and then it was like a giant tidal wave. And when he got booed, it was like, holy shit. And like the funny thing is, when I went out in the Apollo, like all my knobs were turned on my amp. Like I had all these people that were helping me and I was like, yo, you know, they're like, what do you need? I'm like, just make sure my amp is on, you know? And I go out there and all my knobs are turned and my amp was turned off.
Oh,
And I'm like, oh, this is the Apollo Theater saying, like, yo, you better come correct. But, like, I started to feel that tidal wave, and then I turned the amp on, and I was like, this one's from Michael Jackson, and I played a Michael Jackson tune, and I turned the crowd. But it's, like, that level of going through that process, like, it taught me, like, yo, once you go through something like that, nobody can take what you do away from you. So, like, any keyboard gangster that's going to criticize me doing a guitar solo or, like, whatever that's not perfect, I don't care. Because, you know, until you go through these kind of, like, shoes and walk that path, you know this. It's like, you know, people can be critical of comedians, and it's not fair, because I think stand-up comedy is probably the hardest of all of them. And I learned that from my comedian and friends, especially my former co-host who was on the show for a long time, because he said, you know, we don't have a rehearsal. Our performance is our rehearsal. And I was like, what? And he said, yeah, you can write a joke in the privacy of your own home and think it's going to kill. And when you get up there, it bombs. And then you realize that feeling of like, oh my God, I have to work on this to make it right. Tell me what that process has been like for you, because I think it's one of the most captivating parts of comedy.
I feel like that's the toughest part, you know, for me personally. I think one thing I've been, you know, even now it's like, I don't get stage fright, but I'm still working on my confidence on stage at day to day. I feel like now, so long into comedy, I'm able to tackle jokes that I wasn't able to do before, but a lot of it, even watching that joke, I was like, man, I should have been a lot more confident watching that and that clip. You know, there's certain things I'm picking apart, but I think that's the fun part about doing it, is you have an idea, you write it down. And I think over time, the writing gets better. You get to a point where you're like, okay, this is going to work at some level. You don't know if it's going to kill or if it's going to get like chuckles, but like, I know I trust my writing enough now, but a lot of the times now is taking that writing, going to a stage and saying it out loud. Cause a lot of times it's the first time you're saying it out loud. You're banking on hitting gold, like right there. And I mean, if it does, then you're a really good comic or you got lucky that night. It takes a few times to start tweaking it, and you start feeling the rhythm of the joke itself as the words are coming out, you know? I think it's scary. And I think what you said too, when you were at the theater and hearing the person before you doing bad, it comes out of nowhere. Like, you'll be like, oh, this show is going great. And then you're like, oh, the crowd turned. Like, just one small thing, any crowd, you just feel it. And the energy starts dying down. And luckily, if you have a good host that's there, they understand that. And like, I think one thing that's underrated in comedy, I'll get back to what you asked me. Let me know if I'm rambling.
No, it's all right. I love all this. It's all good. That's for the point. I want it to be a candid conversation. It's all good.
Yeah. Like, I think with a good host, you'll see hosts go up and they'll do their like jokes up top and they'll bring up the comic. But the point of the host is to keep the show going. A lot of hosts, and I've seen it here in LA a lot, is they'll go up in between comics. They'll use that as extra time to showcase themselves and do material. And I'm like, that is not, it's not your show. I think as a host, the show is not about you. The show is about everybody else, and you're trying to maintain the room. And good hosts will understand, like, okay, if a comic did really, really good and killed, they'll actually come on stage and they'll settle the audience back down to like a baseline level, to get the other person in to be able to, like, because, you know, somebody might be a really loud comic, really like do a lot of act outs, like screaming. Right. And then somebody might be like a one liner and just stands there and is like, okay, well, today I did this. And like, I thought this happened. And
oh, that's interesting. I've never seen that. That's really slick that you pointed that out, because now when I think about it, it is that host job to kind of bring the barometer back down. So it's like you're wiping the chalkboard clean. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Or vice versa. If a comic just like eats it, that host has to go up and maybe eat a minute or two of time and bring the crowd, maybe do a joke or two and bring the audience back up to, okay, it happens. And I think as long as they don't, I think as a host, you never shit on the comic, because it's, everyone's gone through it. It's tough.
Yeah.
You never shit on the comic and you just bring it back. And that keeps the show smooth. I think the way I learned this was, there's a thing in New York that they do. They don't do it out here much, but it's called the check spot. So the way you come through the scene, you go to an open mic, anybody can sign up. You either pay $5 or you go wait in line. You do like 2 minutes on stage and you do that for like a year or two, whatever. And eventually you get out of that, you start auditioning for these like audition spots at clubs. And depending on the club, like I've done like comic strip where I don't know if they still do it, but years ago they were doing it where it's a lottery system. You show up and you wait at the club. It doesn't matter if it's snowing. I've done it like three times. Twice was in the snow. There's just lines around the block and everyone's getting a lottery number of a date to come back and audition. And you audition at the end of a normal show. So the show will end. And then you audition for whoever's left in the audience. And if you get in, they'll do what's called late night, which is a lot of clubs do it. That's kind of how I came about New York Comedy Club. But at the end of a show, if you get through it, through all those processes, you get passed for late night, where the show is done at midnight and the host will come and be like, hey, we've got our young comics. They're going to be working out their stuff. If you want to stay, you can. If you want to leave, you can go ahead and leave. And then the young comics, the new comics will go up and do 5 minutes at a time. And wow. I've done it where the entire room leaves during your set. So you build that thick skin. But part of graduating from that into actually doing the booked spots is after that, you have these check spots where New York, the way they do it, a lot of clubs tour around the country, they'll have like five or six comics. On the fourth or fifth comic, they'll drop checks for the drinks everyone ordered and the food. And while people are paying, somebody has to be on stage at that time because they can't just get the show. So that's the check spot. So you're going up and it's usually given to the new comics. You're now on stage trying to do your material where maybe 10% of the audience is paying attention.
Wow.
Focused on.
Yeah, because they're paying the bill. Yeah.
And they're like, how are two, Miller Lights like $50? Like what happened here? Like what, and that's kind of the process. And you do those for so long. But I think in that process, you learn how to turn a room that's not on your side and not paying attention to you, how to get their attention. Or like, oh, I see this part's already paid their check. So I'm going to start the jokes to these people. And then you start making your way across.
Wow. And it's just crazy.
It's minute stuff that like it makes an impact and you start picking up on it as you go. But I think that's all comes into the hosting and that comes into like all of that. But there's so much like things that you can't ever learn. Like you have to just It's on the job training, right? Like with music, like say you're playing a string breaks, or the
amp. It's happened many times. And you just have to keep going and keep doing it. And it's like, even when it's like everything goes out of tune. I mean, I've had one of the most terrifying things, one of my bass players in the middle of a gig, his amp head just fell over and started smoking. You know what I mean? And and we had to stop the show. And we're like, okay, we need to stop this. In front of 250 people, we were like, oh my God. And it was terrifying. And one of the other bands like brought their bass head and like saved the day. And we were able to just keep going. And I was just like, thank God, like this is crazy. But Those days, I always hope that those are behind me. You know what I mean? But you never know, because something can come up. You know, I don't know if you see if you've seen the movie The American Symphony with John Batiste.
No,
you should watch this.
Yet. It's on my list.
It's amazing. And one of the things that happens, he's playing Carnegie Hall, and the power goes out for all the performers on the stage. And I won't tell you anything else, because it's like how he pivots is tremendous. And then he makes that part of like the show and every show thereafter. And it's really amazing. And I was just telling my family last night, like, dude, how could this stuff happen at Carnegie Hall? Like, it's just crazy that it happened.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, it's how you pivot. It's that is like what tells you how seasoned you are, when you know you can just like pivot and make something happen. Let's play another one of your bits. What do you want to play next? You want Sam to just choose?
Yeah, you go ahead, Sam.
Sam, it's Russian roulette. You just choose the next one.
I saw something weird the other day. I saw this kid eating a slice of pizza, and he took a bite out of the pizza and threw the rest of it in the trash can. His mom was so mad. She's like, why would you do that? He's like, I didn't like the taste of the pizza. And she looked at him. She's like, really? You didn't like the taste of that pizza? You should be thankful you have that pizza, because there are children in third world countries that are starving. That just got me thinking, what are parents in third world countries telling their kids? Like, is there a kid somewhere coming home from like a 20-hour day at work? Like, mom, I hate this job. She's like, oh, really? You hate your job? You should be thankful you have that job, because there are college graduates in America unemployed. You know, I really got to tell you, you guys are right. That's a great joke. Thanks a lot.
That's brilliant, dude. That was pretty brilliant, dude. How did you come up with that?
That was, you know, that, so that actually happened. So, and so this joke, that clip I sent you is probably from 8 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago. And, I've been tweaking it, and I just started recently redoing it, and I've changed the entire beginning of the whole joke. But that was one of those things. I was sitting with a friend, and we saw this happen, and she's like, "Oh, there's people that are starving." I was like, why are you bringing us into this? First of all, I was like, what the hell's going on? And then I was like, you don't hear that with anything else. And that's the kind of thing sometimes I like, because there's different ways to write jokes. And I like comparing like a parallel, but it's like the exact opposite kind of thing.
Right.
And I was like, it hit me. I was like, oh yeah. I mean, I think this was the time, I think when this happened, there's like a big unemployment thing going on with college, and people are like, is college worth it?
Oh, it's still happening. Still happening. Yeah.
And then I was like, yeah, there's a lot of people that graduated from college that don't have jobs. And then I think it was one of those things I was doing, like like one of the writing things, not to get too into it. It's boring probably for most people, but it's like you have, you make two columns on a sheet of paper, and you write everything that associate with one topic and the other one. And then you see where the parallels are. And then you
oh, that's cool.
So that's kind of how I did that one. And then now I've like changed it into, cause I have a kid now, and I've been like realizing like parenting now, it's so different than our parents and their generation. Right. And now I found a way to combine that with some parenting stuff of how parenting's changed so much and evolved, that like, now you have to have conversations with your kids. And like, you see people that are like, oh, why would you want to do that? And then, so I've combined both of those. And I feel like now the joke is so much better, and it's so much more full. Cause before it was just an observation. Now it's like actual real life experience mixed in.
Right.
And so, yeah, I like that joke still. I the performance, not good.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant joke, because it's like, you don't think about that. Like, you don't think about the inverse of that. And that's what makes it so brilliant. It's like the third world analogy that we have it better than college grads, which is, that's what makes it brilliant. It's like, oh, wow, that is like a reflection of society, of what's happening, you know, in the world here that people don't realize, you know. So let's play another one of your bits. Sam, play another YouTube bit, your choice.
I like the Irish exit. It's when you go to a party, you just leave. You don't have to say bye to anybody. That's beautiful, man. It's a little different than the American goodbye. You know about that one? That's when you show up to a party that you're not invited to, and then you start telling everybody at the party that it's actually your party, and then you kick them all out, and then you tear down the building, and then you put up a Trader Joe's.
That's good, dude. I love that. Tell me, what was the, like, I can tell what was the inspiration behind that, but how did you cultivate that joke?
It's funny, because a lot of these are like political. I'm not a super political comic, but I guess I have some political underlying, or what is it, cultural observations. I think, and that one, obviously, it's a gentrification joke at the base of it.
Right.
And I hate going to parties. I'm like, it's weird, because I know earlier you said people, like a lot of comics are like really funny in person. I feel like I'm not funny in person. Like, I'm the quiet guy at a party. Even, I mean, we met at Rajiv's thing, and I'm usually
right.
I'm just kind of like just sitting. It's not because I don't want to interact. I just don't know how to interact with people.
Well, comedians are observers too, so I respect that. Like, you're observing the party, and I get that. You may want to be more social, but part of what makes you guys great is the fact that you're observing. You know what I mean? So it's cool.
Makes me feel better. Yeah. So, and like, a lot of the times I'm like, I'll be somewhere and I'll be like, I'll just hit a point where I'm like, I can't really socialize anymore. And then, you know, especially on an Indian thing, you say bye, you're talking for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm just going to slink out of here. Maybe I'll show up in a couple of pictures. You'd be like, was he even here? And then I'm like, he was in the picture. I don't remember it. Nobody talked to him, but he was there for a few minutes.
You know what? I think it's important as an artist to know you're in and know you're out. Like, meaning, like, you know when to get in and you know when to get out. And it's something that I'm constantly battling, like, whether it's a social situation, whether it's a conversation, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, because I think so much of it is you never want to overstay your welcome, and you never want to feel like you want to get out and you're trapped. And that happens a lot, as you just said, at a lot of Indian gatherings, but not just Indian gatherings. It just happens, you know, in general, because I think people just, when you're leaving, they want to have the conversation with you that they didn't have when you were there for 45 minutes or 3 hours. You know what I mean? So that just happens. And, but like, one of the things, like, quick goodbyes, I'm like, quick goodbyes, make them happen, get in and get out. You know, like, I got shit to do, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's about making that exit. So, and I think a lot of what you're observing too is that's more important with jokes than anything. Because you have to know when you have to deliver and when you have to, you cannot overstay your welcome with a joke, because you will sour something that was great. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like a Seinfeld when George is like, I'm leaving on a big laugh. He kept like leaving meetings. And stuff. I'm like, that's, it's like, all right, you like me right now. If I stay another 2 minutes, you're probably not going to like me anymore. So
that's very true, though. That's, you know, the timing part of it. You know what I mean? Let's play another bit. I think we got one more bit left. We're going to play this last one.
This is how little they care about you. You get into the car and they're having full-on conversations with their relatives on speakerphone. You know how many times I had to pretend that I don't speak Hindi so I could eavesdrop on all of those conversations? Nowadays, I gotta pretend like I don't speak English so I can stay out of conversations. And I'm not like a confrontational person. Like, I don't like confrontation. So I won't say that I don't want to talk to you. What I will do is some passive aggressive shit where I'll put my headphones in my ear. Because I feel like that should be a universal sign that I don't want to have a conversation. Right? Like, kind of like when, you know, you go to a club, hit on a girl, and you see she's got an engagement ring on. That's a universal sign, too. That you got to bring your A game.
I like that. That's good. That's good. So tell me what.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
No. So how did you cultivate that?
So that joke. So the beginning, I had to cut the beginning because for the reels or whatever. But the whole observation is how I don't like going into Ubers now because they all, and like I said, I don't like to have super, like, I'm not a talker. So like, I hate on Ubers where they're always trying to have conversations with you. Like, I'd like to just sit there quietly. And that's like my sweet spot. And I realized, I'm like, oh, like, taxi drivers in New York, they do not do that. Like, they don't care about you. And that's kind of where it started. Like, you'll get into a taxi and sometimes you'll say something. They don't even acknowledge where you're going. Like, they don't even acknowledge it, you know? And I'm like, oh, I prefer taxis because they just, whatever, you do your own thing. I'm going to have a conversation on the phone here. And we both acknowledge that we're both in a moment together. And that's it. So that's kind of where that idea came from. And I just started playing with it. And then I came into like the universals. I had done that ending as a different joke years ago and it wasn't working. Like a universal sign of like the engagement thing. And I'm like, oh, let me kind of combine, like mash these together, like Frankenstein and see. And it's working. Cause it's like, it turns into like a dating joke at the end of the day without.
Right.
So yeah, that's about it. But yeah, that was, that's just something I know. I'm like, yeah, I'm not a conversational. I mean, been talking to you for an hour, but I mean, this has been fun. This has been,
because we're talking about the art and like we're both artists, and that's kind of why I started this, because what I love about this is you have two artists talking about their creative processes, and it makes both of our processes better knowing what the other is going through, because there's no part of the process that allows you to know what you're doing is correct, because you have to just go through it and walk through it and experience it, and it's a battle you go through by yourself. So when you see there's a parallel in another art form, you're like almost relieved, like, oh man, okay, cool, this is just how it is, and it's kind of like a relief. And you know, misery loves company, you know what I mean, so to speak. So it's like one of those things. But you know, really what it comes down to is art is a community. And I think artists, we don't have these conversations enough with other artists, because we need these, because you know, going out and just performing, it's not enough. It's like having these conversations to know like how we cultivate, how to make an impact, how we observe, how we kind of like go through the process, how we fail. That's such a relief knowing that other people go through the same parallels and experiences, even if it's a different medium. So yeah, that's why we do this, man. So never apologize, bro. Where can people find you if they want to find your comedy online?
Yeah, please follow me on social media. I'm at Mahesh Kotagi, MaheshKotagi. TikTok, if you type it in, I'll come up. It's Mahesh Kotagi Comedy. Yeah, follow me on Instagram. We got to push the metrics up. I'm trying to get go viral. All my shows and stuff are on there. This comes out today. So Thursday, I'm recording for Netflix as a joke, radio for SiriusXM. They're doing sets with comics. So I'll be at the Troubadour Theater in West Hollywood, I believe.
Awesome.
So come check that
out. What's that date? That's Thursday?
Thursday the 11th, yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome. That's amazing. That's one of the most iconic venues. I played there twice, and yeah, I love that venue.
Yeah, it's cool, right? It's a very, like, it's like a historic
venue. Dude, it's like Elton John, James Taylor, you know, the Eagles. Man, I saw Seal there. I've seen Coldplay there. It's an iconic venue, you know?
I'm excited for it, man. Yeah, it's a nice way to start the year. I'm thankful for it, and hopefully it keeps pushing for the year. And I'll be in the comedy clubs. I'm doing a tour this year where I'll be going around. So if you liked what you saw, if you whatever, you like jokes, hit me up. Let me know what city you're in. I'll come out. I'd love to get your email addresses. I think that's everyone's doing social media. I think email addresses are going to last longer than, you know, all these social medias. But I love doing it. Thanks for having me, man. It's great catching up again. It's been a while, and it was
fun. You gotta let me know when you're performing, dude. I'm so down to come see you play, man. So
I've been wanting to come check you out too.
Well, we'll have to make that happen, dude, and we'll have to make a little Indian hang where we eat some spicy food.
Let's do it. I'll give it a try.
I'm gonna test your Indian hood right there. I'm gonna be like, hey, bro, we're gonna see what level of Indian you are. If you are more white than you are Indian, then my respect will either grow for you or dwindle into, you know, lack of respect.
I think it's gonna go to lack of respect.
Well, you're from Texas, dude. You were in the wrong neighborhood, dude. You didn't learn. They didn't teach you well. No, I'm just kidding.
I can make a good chili.
You're like, and I've got some cowboy boots to boot, you know. But I appreciate you being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. You know, the reason I started this show is to follow artists throughout their career, so we're gonna have you back, you know, about 9 or 10 months. I'm gonna have you come back, and we welcome all your new material, and we think the world of you. I mean, thanks. That's why you're on the show, man. This is what it's about. Thank you, man. That means so a lot. Yeah, man. So keep doing your thing, and you got to let me know next time you perform in L.A. Absolutely. And we got to hang. And thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. On behalf of Sam, myself, and Mahesh, we'll see you guys next week. Peace, love, take care of each other, and we out.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence. Right here on LA Talk Radio.